Welcome to Nos Audientes, your Sounder at Heart podcast, where we're going to talk about all things Seattle Sounders. I'm Jeremiah O'Shan. I'm here with Aaron Campo. Hope you're enjoying your weekday afternoon or your weekend afternoon, and you're punching this in right before the game, because that's the way to do it, is to like just power all your Sounders information right before the game.
Absolutely.
So we should probably talk about last week's game, because that's makes sense in a timeline-y kind of way.
I think so, yeah.
I did not go to the game. Not only did I not go, but I didn't watch the game live, which was kind of hard, but I did listen to it. And just to get it out of the way, I actually was really impressed with Arlo White's radio call, not to beat that into the ground. But I did watch the game, so I feel like I can talk about it authoritatively now. But what were your general impressions? I will just say that I am amazed. That goal that O'Brien White scored was very, very impressive.
It was absolutely ridiculous goal. And I was actually in a section of GA where you can see pretty much everything, and I had a fantastic view of the goal, and I was still really confused when it ended up actually being a goal. I didn't really see how that was possible from the distance that the cross went into, and the fact that O'Brien White was in the crowd of two players, and I mean, I'm not even ragging on O'Brien White.
It was an awesome goal. It was I think the first time I voted for a Sounders goal for goal of the week, where I actually thought it was the best goal of the week.
It was an amazing goal, and part of the reason that I was so impressed with it was a good service. It wasn't a great service, and O'Brien White was able to. He whipped it. I mean, he whipped it from 15 yards, 16 yards out. I mean, it's an amazing thing that you probably won't see happen again. Listening to it on the radio, I assume that Sean Johnson must have been just totally out of position and somehow caught out of – but he just put it in a place that there's no way you expect it to go if you're Sean Johnson.
Yeah,
the ball in, like you were saying, was kind of a searching ball. It was kind of hopeful. There were two Sounders in the box, and they both kind of drifted towards O'Brien White, which ended up being the correct decision. And O'Brien White, like you said, I mean, he got a lot of force behind it, put it pretty much in exactly the right place. I mean, he was behind in front of two defenders,
went up,
just kind of out-jumped them and just snapped it in. I mean, with the force of like a pretty solid volley, then, you know, there was nothing anybody could do about it. And it wasn't poor defending, it wasn't poor goalkeeping, it was just a really, really good individual effort from O'Brien White.
And it kind of came out of nowhere in a way that, I mean, I guess that kind of speaks to the point of it. But it was just like, you know, a mild build-up, and then all of a sudden there's a ball in back of the net.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, the way that game felt, I mean, all three goals were kind of the same way, really. I mean, the Chicago goal was definitely a lack of concentration, I think. I mean, after the goal was scored, I think most people in the stadium kind of felt the same way, like what just happened, and it was a pretty rocky atmosphere. The start of the game was
kind of subdued. It's first day game of the year, so, you know, people still sleepy or got their hangovers or whatever from the night. And that kind of woke everybody up, and unfortunately, it seems like it kind of put the Sounders to sleep, and, you know, what was it, a minute later? Chicago record?
Yeah, something like 90 seconds, something like that.
And then Zach Kalani's goal was the same, and it was another really impressive individual effort where, you know, there was never really a point where he had a whole lot of space when he got that ball. I mean, he got the ball off the touchline, was kind of just jogging down, and then he pops it into a little bit of space that, you know, he can create because of the speed. Made a nice pass to O'Brien White, who made an absolutely fantastic first-time pass into space to Zach Kalani, and Zach Kalani, you know, just fired it into the near post in a really small amount of space. Both goals were, you know, there were definitely things done by other people. Rosales' cross was a good one. I mean, it wasn't amazing or anything, but it was a good one into a dangerous area. O'Brien White's first-time pass to Zakuani was heady and well-executed, but, you know, O'Brien White made the first goal. Zakuani made the second one pretty much all by themselves, and it was cool to see, and then the rest was kind of boring.
Yeah, and that was something that is kind of apparent. There's a pretty big lull in that game, probably from minute 35 up until maybe minute 65 or so, when Nate Jaquet comes in, where it just kind of fell into this. They were just kind of trading positions in the midfield, and there wasn't a lot going on, and it was amazing listening to it on the radio and then watching it, and I kind of got the same impression both times, which was the Sounders started in a way that was just electric. I mean, the game was electric in the first 35 minutes or so, and then kind of in the same way that the San Jose game was very similar, where it was like just everybody came out and it was, you know, passes were being connected and all this stuff, and it was just amazing up and down action, and then it kind of settles in and it turns into a, you know, a little bit more of a mundane soccer match. But I guess the thing that I think you have to ask after this game is, not only do you have O'Brien White performing very well, and I don't think there's any way that you can dispute that O'Brien White has looked like an entirely different player the last two games than he had the first three.
Yeah, he had a great game again on Saturday.
And then you have Nate Jaquia now, who looked, I thought, I mean, I went through and I did my patented positive and negative touches thing that I'm going to put a patent on and start marketing it to Opta. But I don't have my stat sheet in front of me, of course, but I counted about 20 touches from Nate Jaquia in his 35 minutes or so of play. He had no negative touches, which is the first time I've doing this that I've found someone that didn't have any negative touches. He had something like 7 positive touches, and 3 of them led to really clear goal scoring opportunities. None of them ended up being goals, but he made 3 passes. He made, I want to say there was one to Steve Zakuani along the left wing that was a good pass that I guess I gave him credit for a goal scoring opportunity on. He had the pass to Zakuani where he was essentially left one-on-one with the goalkeeper. Maybe not one-on-one with the goalkeeper, but it was that ball over the top.
Yeah.
And then he had that other one to Servando Carrasco, who really, I don't know, should have scored is probably unfair.
No, I think he should have scored.
But it was, you know, he just had some great touches on balls. And it's amazing to think, I mean, it's you know, we're only 2 games away from talking about how we really needed a serious striker. But at this point, are we really even worried about trying to find a, you know, if we're going to spend designated player money, is it really, do we want to spend that on a striker at this point?
I'm definitely not as clear on that as I was maybe 2 weeks ago. O'Brien White, like you said, has really turned it on the last couple of games. We have the same kind of sample now that we have from the first 2 games, when I think most of us were convinced that maybe he wasn't the answer. And so, you know, I'm not jumping to any conclusions and saying that he's absolutely this good.
But it's definitely encouraging. And, you know, like you said with Jaquia, he brings something that's very different from O'Brien White, but he brings something that's pretty good as well. And I think that if the right player is available at that position, then, you know, yeah, you go for it. Because I don't think that what we have now is an elite striker, an elite target.
Yeah, and I think that we probably both agree that if not to be too hyperbolic, but if Didier Drogba falls into our laps, we're not going to turn our nose up, or Diego Forlan. I mean, we're not talking about, like, turning down these all-world talents. I think what we're both talking about is if we're going to go out these mid-tier guys that, you know, the Blaise Kufos of the world, or, you know, maybe even Blaise Kufos is better. You know, I would probably still take him at this point.
Yeah.
If, you know, if you fit in. But if we're talking about these kind of like Eric Osley kind of characters, like is that someone that we really want to, you know, take a chance on and spend a DP on when we already have 2 guys that are probably capable of performing at, you know, a mid, you know, a decent MLS level of play?
Yeah,
I think at that position, you know, we have league average talent at this point, I think is a fair way to put it. We have above league average talent at the wings. And, you know, I know that they're referred to as the left and right midfield, but I mean, they're attacking players. They're winners. We have Freddy Montero, who I think in the role that he plays, for one, not a lot of other players in MLS play the role he plays. And those that do at that sort of second forward, not necessarily a primary scoring option, aren't anywhere near as dangerous as he is. So really you're looking for something different out of the target forward spot, I think, in Seattle than you are a lot of other places. And so, no. You know, I mean, Eric Housley has been pretty great.
In Vancouver. Not getting sent off. Which
does do with an alarming regularity.
It's pretty insane. So just to sidetrack a little bit, I don't know whether Eric Housley is the stupidest person that I've ever heard of or encountered, or if he's just the worst liar of all time. I don't know, but there's no way his excuse for getting the second yellow
was that he didn't think he would get the yellow because he had another jersey. I mean, that either takes an extreme lack of IQ or an extreme overabundance of balls. I don't know which one it is, but I love him, I think, for it. But anyway.
Well, actually, I don't want to get too far sidetracked, but just a real quick answer. Who's dumber, him or is it Neymar?
I think it's Neymar.
Neymar?
I think it's Neymar.
That sounds more Hispanic. Yeah. Although, I guess he's probably Portuguese. That's probably a more Portuguese name.
Yeah.
Anyway, who's dumber?
It's tough to say. I think that if Neymar had put the mask on right side up, I might think that maybe he was a little brighter.
Neymar listened to someone that told him to stay in Brazil instead of going to Chelsea, so I'm not sure he's that bright in the first place. But I don't know. I mean, honestly, I think Housley might just be a troll. Like, I legitimately think that he might just be trolling MLS. If that's true.
It's really amazing, right?
It's pretty awesome. Yeah, I he's one of my favorite non-sounders right now.
I can't help but love the guy. I mean, it's like you're gonna get your money's worth if you go watch a Vancouver Whitecaps game and Eric Housley is playing. You are going to get a show. I mean, he's gonna score a goal. He's gonna do something. You've probably, like, I don't know. I don't think any. I would love to have found a definitive answer if an MLS player had ever been sent off immediately after scoring a goal before.
It seems like maybe it would have had to happen, but.
I mean, the rule is pretty new. It's only 2 years.
Yeah. No, I guess that's true.
I guess that's true.
And, I mean, I can't imagine that it's ever happened under that circumstance.
Sitting on a yellow where you've only been in the game for 10 minutes.
Right. And it's incredible. I mean, I hope he does something stupid funny when we play Vancouver instead of something, you know, just awesome in terms of scoring. But yeah. But I mean, he's very talented and he's done very well for them. And he's also hilarious. I mean, he's not. I don't want to say he's like Ocho Cinco because he's not quite to that level of comedic genius, but he's in the same mold, I think.
He also has prison tattoos.
Does he really?
He's like a spider web.
He has a spider web, yeah, which kind of freaked me out when I first saw it. But
it's not really a prison tattoo. I mean, yeah. We were in 2011. I think that it was probably a prison tattoo in '95.
Right. I was thinking maybe he had like the teardrop or something.
Oh, that would have been much more hardcore. Where were we?
I think we're talking about designated players that were not strikers.
Right. Okay. Well, that does bring me, now you put me back on where I wanted to go with this conversation, is Freddy Montero was training with the Sounders today. Now, granted, training today happened to be playing softball.
Right.
But we were told that he would have been involved as a neutral if they were actually playing soccer today. And I think it's probably safe to assume that if he doesn't come back, I mean, I think he'll probably be back this week. If he's not back this week, he'll be back next week. So it's now time to ask, how does the lineup, you know, we've had a pretty successful run with the lineup as it is now, where you essentially have Obi as the target forward, you have Mauro Rosales as the withdrawn forward, you have Eric Freeberg on the right, you have Zach Wani on the left, you have Brad Evans in the middle and Alonso behind him. We'll leave the back line out of it, but what's the change that you would like to see? What's the change you think is going to happen? And how do you think that changes things?
I think the change I'd like to see is, you know, probably fairly obvious to anyone who's been paying attention. I would like to see Mauro Rosales go out right. I think he's absolutely earned an opportunity to start regularly for this team. And You know, I think he's one of the best 10 outfield players on the team. I don't really think that much is in question. And if we want him at 90-minute match fitness, he needs to keep playing. And then in the central midfield spot, I'd go with a rotation that leans heavily towards Alvaro Fernandez, at least to start with. You know, the whole Alvaro situation, we've been over it so many times, and it's confusing to me. But I think that you have to give him the opportunity to play regularly. And then Freeburg would definitely be my second choice at that position, and then Evans. But I think it's reasonable to say that two of those three, of Fernandez, Evans, and Freeburg, would get playing time in every game, and all three of them would probably get playing time in most games. I mean, I think that whoever of those three doesn't start has got to be your first, you know, your first priority coming off the bench. Freeburg is, as we talked about earlier, before we started, is a very high-risk, high-reward player. He does some fantastic things. He's very energetic. He's aggressive without being dumb, I guess is the best way to put it. But he does give the ball away a lot. He does make some poor decisions with the ball. And I think he'll improve as, you know, maybe he gets used to the league and the physicality and that sort of thing. But, you know, Brad Evans is a little steadier. I thought he had an absolutely fantastic game against Chicago.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where I don't have my numbers in front of me and it wasn't quite as clear, but I know he went something like the first 30 or 35 minutes without a negative touch, which for Brad Evans, who, like, I went through the San Jose film, and as good as I thought Evans was when I first watched it, he actually had a pretty mediocre game against San Jose. He had a much better, I mean, he had a really good game against the Fire. I mean, he won, and I really, it's not even exaggerating. I mean, he won something like 90% of his aerial battles. I mean, he was all over the place on headers. He had a lot of quick touches. He wasn't holding on to the ball very long. You know, he didn't have a lot of goal dangerous plays. He wasn't setting up a lot of, he had one play that did come pretty close to leading to a goal. But he was much more of the kind of the Brad Evans that we kind of have come to either know and love or kind of get very frustrated with, in that he wasn't doing a lot of stuff that was, I mean, he had a lot of positive passes in that he was moving the action forward, but he wasn't doing a lot that was really challenging goal situations.
Right.
But, I mean, he's the kind of player where if you have really dynamic wings like a Zach Iwani and a Mauro Rosales or Alvaro Fernandez or, I mean, really, even Eric Freeburg. I mean, if you have those kinds of players, Brad Evans is actually a very useful center mid, and I can see, you know, on days like Saturday, you can really see why Siggy is in love with him as much as he is.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think my biggest frustration with this is that the depth that we have in this league, the quality of the depth that we have at, you know, the slots that usually eat up the most in your budget in these midfield spots of average to above to highly above average players is a blessing, and it feels like a curse because I don't think that Siggy is willing to use his depth. I just don't, and it's, you know, it feels like a waste of resources. I mean, we have some holes that are fairly big, and maybe you don't want to spend a DP slot on them, like, you know, maybe some depth at the outside backs, maybe depth up top at the target forward position, and then we have, you know, these players that are sitting there eating up a you know, not insignificant portion of the budget that I just don't feel like are going to play. And, you know, they'll play in the cup competitions, they'll play in the Champions League, but, you know, I think that it's imperative of a coach who has the reputation that Siggy has to be able to use his depth in the league, and I just don't.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that, you know, maybe at game five, it's maybe too early to pass too much judgment on this year, but I think what you're basing that off of, and is perfectly legitimate, which is his track record, which he doesn't do a lot of rotational, you know, we don't see Siggy playing a lot of matchups, we don't see him playing a lot of, you know, he's not rotating guys in just to kind of keep them fresh. I think with a situation like John Kenny Hurtado, it's, at least to me, it seems pretty obvious that was really a a calculated decision to give him a couple of weeks off just to kind of get his head, you know, he's coming back from a pretty severe injury. But that's an extreme situation, and whereas he doesn't seem as willing to do that with offensive players, like,
yeah.
I think it's an absolute, it's a real shame that Alvaro, I mean, he's only gone 1 week without playing, but, I mean, a guy like Alvaro Fernandez should not be on the bench for 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah. No, no. And, I mean, the thing that I think is funny about that is you make a good point. He's willing to do that with his defense. Well, that's weird that you'd be willing to do that with your defense where the working relationship is, I think, much more important than it is with your attacking players. You know, the coaches generally don't like to break up their defenses. They like to keep the center back pairing intact. They like to, you know, the outside backs. They want them all to play together as much as possible. Ziggy seems less concerned with that because, you know, Hurtado was fit as far as everyone knows, but, you know, he got a little breather, which he probably needed, but I don't think he'd be, I mean, he started Eric Freeburg with the flu. Like, I don't, you know, and it's just frustrating because from the standpoint of there are players that I want to see playing more, and that's going to become even more the case once Freddie gets back, but it's also a research point, especially in a league like him. Like, if we didn't have a salary cap in this league, it probably wouldn't bother me as much, but there's a finite amount of money that you can spend, and you have a lot of it wrapped up in players that aren't going to play that much, and it's frustrating because I don't really see any reason.
All right, well, I have an interview with Steve Zakuani. That's a pretty harsh transition.
It is, but now we need something happy now, I think.
Yeah, so we talked to Steve last week before the Fire game. I'm not exactly sure how this is going to be edited, but I have a feeling that it's going to be pretty obvious that this conversation happened before the Fire game. And basically what happened was we talked about the prospect of facing a 3-5-2, and the good news is that blossomed into a much more interesting conversation about Steve and his kind of love of football and his enjoyment. And anyway, I'll let you listen to that, and we'll be back in a little while.
So you guys have been playing the Fire. They've been running a 3-5-2. You guys probably haven't seen really much of anything quite like that, I don't think, since you saw DC United a couple years ago. But, I mean, does that pose any kind of different?
I mean, it can, but we saw Chicago in preseason, and they were playing, 3-5-2, and it was a tough adjustment. It is. If a team can play that position, that formation well, it makes playing out of a 4-4-2 tough. But at the end of the day, it's still 11-11. So I think you get to a stage where it doesn't matter what they're going to come in, you're still going to be matched up because it's 11-11. So we know what to adjust. We did it against DC in the Open Cup final my first year, and even the game here at Quest, and Chicago in the preseason. So, so I just feel it's something where it's different, but we can adjust. We've seen it enough.
How does it differ? I mean, it seems like the wings would seem to have more different responsibilities because you have guys kind of coming up from farther back in the field.
I mean, no, not really, because when we have the ball, they become a 5 in the back.
Uh-huh.
It becomes a 5-3-2 because they really
pull
the guys back, so that becomes tougher to break them down. But when they have the ball, it's easy because then you can just match up against the 3 in the back. You keep a forward high, send your 2 wingers to one of the 4. I'm going to give our tactics away, but
No.
It becomes easy, you know. It becomes, it's easy. It's just about matching up. As long as we stay 11-11, they can come in a 5, in a 6, in a back, whatever. You're going to always have the right numbers. So we tweak a bit, adjust a little bit, but at the end of the day, I think they expose themselves a bit, because if you can win the ball up high against 3, you're 3 against 3. So, we saw them in preseason, and it was interesting, but as the game went on, we got used to it a bit more. So I just feel 3-5-2, I think it's more of a 5-3-2 personally. Because the way they play with the personnel they had, they were very defensive. We were hard to break them down in preseason because there are so many guys back. So, it can be tough to break that down. But sounds good saying 3-5-2, but for me, it's more of a 5. It was more of a 5. So.
And do you kind of do enjoy seeing, I mean, that seems like this year especially, you're seeing teams running out of more. It seemed like for the last year at least, it was like everyone was a 4-4-2, maybe kind of a slight differentiation. But, I mean, do you kind of enjoy seeing that kind of different stuff every week?
I think it's good. I think, without saying too much, I think the best footballing team in our league is Real Salt Lake. I think they've been for a couple of years, and you watch them and they play, you know, a very pinched in 4. Those guys just interchange. I'm not going to say it's Barcelona, but it's Andy Williams and you
right.
are. Will Johnson and Morales Beckerman, and they just interchange him, which is tough to play against. And I think in this league, we're getting to that stage now where we're starting to see a lot of different things. It's been 4-4-2 in the past, because in Europe, I mean, all the top teams play 4-3-3.
Right.
No one plays 4-4-2 anymore. It's gone out in England, it's gone out in Spain. I mean, Barca, Madrid, and Man U, and Chelsea, all these teams play 4-3-3 mostly now. So I think you're seeing that more and more here. I think it's just, okay, 4-4-2 is safe in a way. And the formation doesn't really matter too much, but I think when you, depends on your personnel too. We had a couple 4-3-3 games last year. Remember Columbus crew came here, we played out a 4-3-3. And I think maybe a couple other games. But yeah, it just, I think you'll see it.
Toronto maybe.
Yeah, you'll just see it as the league grows and, you know, different coaches come in, different ideas. You see different playing style, different formations. So, because in Europe, it's changed. It's changed.
Right.
There's no more 4-4-2. I mean, yeah.
I mean, you strike me as someone who does kind of enjoy the tactical part of it a little bit, that you kind of, you watch this stuff, that you see what's going on. I mean, so it, I mean, is it, do you enjoy looking at it from that way? Do you enjoy kind of like looking at teams and saying, okay, look at how they're doing it, and not just putting the ball at the feet and running?
No. I love football. I mean, I watch all kinds of football. I can be at home in my house, and if I have some spare time, I can watch League One, League Two games from England. I can watch Spanish Second Division. I love football. Because I think it's always interesting to see different styles, different teams. I mean, the most obvious example is Barcelona. And you ask yourself, why did they keep the ball for so long? And you say, they have Vinicius, they have Xavi, they have Messi. But for me, I think every team should try and master that, because it's unique. I mean, usually we want to keep against the ball, you have the outside back spread, but Barca put the two centre-backs out there and sent Alves and it was Abidal up. So I think that's something people should try and mirror more, because they're keeping the ball, and if you have the ball, you're going to have more chances. So, yeah, I watch that kind of stuff a lot. We talk about it amongst ourselves. It's just sometimes it's tough in this league. I think this league's a league where the game's played at such a speed that it can be hard sometimes to just settle the game and see things. And that's why I think when you become a better player, you start to get to that stage. I mean, I can watch a Landon, for example, Di Rosario, two players I really look up to, and think to myself, what are they doing week in, week out to get them to a certain level, and then see how they fit into the team's tactics. So I think you do it first as an individual. What's the role of a left midfielder, left winger, whatever, and then you fit that into the bigger picture. So it's intriguing to me. Very intriguing.
And so kind of talking about the kind of fan of the game thing, I mean, how big of a deal do you think it is for MLS to now have a team in the CONCACAF finals, and I mean, they're going to be playing a Monterrey team that you guys played.
Yeah.
I mean, how is that?
Huge. We're all behind Salt Lake. I only saw the first half of the last game, but this is the second half, but they played well. I think it's a good statement for MLS, and when you get a team like them who actually play football, it's going to open up the eyes of the world or this region to see that, hold on, these guys are catching on. Because for me personally, if you look at this league, it gets a very bad rap, I think, but I don't think that's really fair, because it's a decent standard. It's a high standard, because you have some of the top quote unquote European players coming here, and how many of them have actually shown that this league is terrible? Not many. I couldn't think of one that's really just been a class above, because they've all been good, but there's really good players here. So yeah, I think it's something where when we play Barca, we play Chelsea, we play Man U, gives a bit of a false, because Barca will beat you 5-0, 6-0, but they do the same thing to teams in Spain.
Right.
So I want to see us play Sunderland and play Wigan and play these teams and then see if we can match up. So I think those would be closer games, for example. So, I think the league's growing. It's great for Salt Lake to be the team to do that, because they play some good football. They deserve it. And for that final, I think everyone's going to be behind it, hoping they can go for sure. So it's a good look for MLS, 100%.
Yeah, well, appreciate it. Take fun.
Hopefully you enjoyed that. Steve is a very, let's see, what's the right way to put this? He's a great interview. I'll just put it that way. He's got a lot of really interesting things to say. He's a very enjoyable person.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So anyway, this week we have the Philadelphia Union. We're going to PPL Park, which we are reminded is in a not so bad part of town, because the reason it's not so bad is because you need because they have armed guards to protect you.
Right.
So what's your problem, dude?
Yeah, I know. Oh, who wouldn't? That would reassure me.
Yeah.
When I go to the airport, and this happened to me coming back from San Francisco, and I find out that they've raised the security level, and I see people toting around weapons in the airport that are uniformed, I feel totally safe.
Yeah, right?
Because they've got my back. They're looking out for me.
Right.
What's the fear?
Right. So
you see that sort of thing.
Yes. I mean, because to me, what I see, not that... That's a harp on this too much. But when I see armed guards, I think, wow. I'm glad that those guards are totally unnecessary.
Right.
Because they've obviously scared off all the evildoers.
That tends to be what happens.
Yeah.
When people show up to a place with weapons, it tends to kind of end any bad things that were going to happen.
Yeah.
I think we've seen
that throughout history.
If
you show up with weapons, everything will be – it means that everything's going to be okay from that point out.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree with that. So anyway, PPL Park is where the Sounders will be playing this week. We will be facing a Philadelphia Union team that has allowed one goal in four matches.
Sustainable.
And there's no reason to think that that's not perfectly sustainable pace.
Right.
And they've scored three goals in four matches, which is probably sustainable.
Right.
Yes. But all in all, I think that makes them the second best team in MLS.
Without a question, they are their 3-1 season long score is indicative of a team that will probably run away with the Supporter Shield, wouldn't you say?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, Real Salt Lake, you know, they can't keep up this pace. They can't keep doing it. But I think we've learned something about the Union that we didn't know about Real Salt Lake over these four.
No, and so all kidding aside, the Sounders are facing a Union team that is, in fact, I think we can agree, is probably better than the Union team that we saw dismantle the Sounders.
Yes.
But and to be fair, though, there was a lot of extenuating circumstances in that game. It was the first game back from the break. It was their real home opener. They had played two games at the Link, I believe, the people in Philadelphia.
Not speaking Jews at the Clink.
Right.
Which is a terrible nickname for a stadium, by the way.
It was the home opener. It was the PPL opener for the Union when we were there. It was about 112 degrees.
I think so.
With a humidity of about 102.
Yeah,
that seems about right. The heat index was well over the boiling point of water.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the Sounders melted in that heat. If I remember, a Pat Noonan goal and also a Pat Noonan penalty that was saved. So anyway, this is a team that's better than the team that beat the Sounders 3-1. But, I mean, what do we take? I mean, do we really know that much about the Union at this point? I mean, I think we know that they have a better goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we can agree that they probably have an improved defense. Is their offense as bad as they – I mean, their offense has looked downright bad.
The thing that's funny is that I make fun of the Union, and, you know, they're not a bad team. I think they were a bad team last year. At this point, though, they're really not. Like, they're a pretty good team, and I think that their defensive improvement is real, and to answer your question, no, I don't think their offense is that bad. And the funny thing is that I don't think they're going to keep up this pace in terms of earning points, but, you know, I think they're a decent team. I think this is a pretty dangerous game. PPL is, by all accounts, a fairly tough place to play, and, you know, I can easily see them being in one of those automatic playoff spots. I watched the New York game. I didn't think they were especially impressive in that game, but they did pretty much exactly what they wanted to do.
And then they forced New York to kind of make do with less than ideal chances. New York being New York hit the post approximately 1,100 times in the game. But, you know, you hit the post a lot more often when you're taking less than ideal chances, so there's some credit to that. Mondragon is a pretty good goalkeeper. I mean, I think that he's, you know, probably one of the better goalkeepers in the league, and that's definitely an improvement for them. Danny Califf has managed to not kill anyone yet, so they've managed to keep their defense intact. And, you know, this is – I don't think the Union are as good as the results have been so far. I think they might be better than they've looked at times, which is, you know, obviously counterintuitive, but we're talking about four games. So, and, yeah, it wouldn't really surprise me to see the Sounders take a point or less in this game.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a realistic. I think the Sounders will probably be very happy to take a point from this game.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, if the Sounders figure out a way to win, that's obviously great, but I don't think that there's an expectation that the Sounders are going to win in the way that they maybe were expecting to win some of their previous games. But I'm wondering, Sebastian Letou, we have a conversation coming up that we'll get into this a little bit more with Scott Kessler of Brotherly Game, but I'm curious what you saw Sebastian, you saw Seba, I guess.
Yeah.
This is what we like to call him here.
He's a Franco-American hero.
Right, and he was here. You know, I assume you have much more clear recollections of his time in Seattle than I do. I mean, do you see him as an entirely different player? I mean, is this shocking to you to see the player he's become and subsequently kind of this year seeming to kind of come back to earth a little bit?
Well, I think that last year was a surprise. It wasn't as big a surprise, though, as maybe you would expect. Everyone always thought that he had maybe not that in him, but something better in him. And I just think he was playing out of position. And, you know, people are critical of the decision to let him go, and that's understandable to a second point, or to a certain point, just because of, you know, the numbers he put up in Philadelphia. But, you know, he was their number one option. He was the style of game they play, he was their option.
I think their offense was called Seba.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, they was like, get him the ball, and they did. And, you know, the Sounders had talent that really didn't make that the best, you know, the best way to play going forward. And there are players that can thrive in that role and kind of disappear when you know, they're asked to do something different. And that's not at all a dig at him, because I, you know, I will always have a very he'll always have a special place in my heart. And this is just a better situation for him, or at least it was last year. And, you know, I think that that's kind of the thing is, you know, it's too early to judge for sure what's going to happen this year. He might get right back into the swing of things, but he's not playing the same sort of role that he did last year. And I think that that's evident from his play. He hasn't been as dynamic as he was with Philadelphia. He hasn't been the focal point so far that he was. And I think a lot of that has to do with some tactical changes that Novak has made. Dave alluded to this. I think it was in the comments on the site, but it might have been in a post. I don't know. You know, Philadelphia is playing a little more conservatively, to be charitable, I guess is how I'll say it. And you know they counter, but maybe not with the fervor that they did last year. I don't think they feel like they need to score as much, and it's going to limit its effectiveness.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be that it was a unsustainable. I don't remember the exact statistic, but something like 65% of their scoring ran through Seba last year, and that's just not a sustainable way to win. I mean, it's a sustainable way to generate, to run your offense if that's your goal, is just to produce points for a player. But it just doesn't seem like you can't win that way. I mean, even with Chris Wondolowski scoring something like 54% of his team's goals, he wasn't accounting for as high of a percentage of his team's offense because there were other people feeding him the ball.
Right.
And it's just and so when you have so much of your offense running through one player, it's just so much easier to just shut everyone else down. And I mean, you just can't. One guy is not going to beat a team. And so I think it's maybe a credit to Peter Novak to you know, peel away from the Seba offense.
I think so, and I think, you know, they've made some additions that I think allow them to be a little more comfortable, maybe not attacking as much, and maybe holding on to a little bit more of the possession, although they're still very much primarily a counterattacking team. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you can do that, I think, when you're an expansion team, and you know, maybe your best shot is to just say, all right, this is by far our best and most creative player. He doesn't have a lot around him. We're just going to kind of let him do his thing. Well, when you improve and you add talent, you can't really justify doing that anymore. Cause you know, why are you using resources to bring in creative players if they're not going to see the ball and they're not going to help create? So, I mean, there are maybe a handful of players in the league that could have that sort of role and see it be successful. And I don't know if he's one of them.
All right. Well, we're gonna do. We had an interview with Scott Kessler, a Brother of Game. We'll go to that now, and we'll be back and finish it up. I'm here with Scott Kessler of the Brother of Game, SB Nation's Philadelphia Union blog. First off, what do you think of this game? I mean, last year the Sounders went into Philadelphia and got absolutely demolished. It was a hot day. I don't know how much of that game you remember. Maybe you were in the stands. Maybe you weren't. Let's start with there. What's your recollection of last year's game?
I seem to remember three goals.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the sides. And I seem to remember a former Sounder having a part in a majority of that game. You know,
who
that...
could you possibly be talking about? I don't know who this person is you speak of.
When it came down to it, it was Latu last season, and it was Tony Stahl not playing in that second game. That really did help.
So it's Tony Stahl's absence is what helped.
Well, the defense, though it still wasn't good at that point in the season. Tony Stahl being played out of position because he was a Big East player he was a great Big East player at midfield in college, but getting shifted back in the defense obviously wasn't his cup of tea, and having Michael Roscoe-Fiscal and Danny Califf, if I'm not mistaken, those were the two playing in the game at the time, was better than having Tony Stahl.
So do you think you can take anything away from that game, or do you think that this year's the two teams are different enough that there's really not a lot that you can say, oh, well, last year we beat the Sounders 3-1 at home, so this year it'll be the same thing?
Well, Zach Iwani's a better player now than he was last year. Nufko's gone. Was he even with the team last year at that point?
I don't think he was. No, he wasn't. He wasn't. He hadn't joined the team yet, or he hadn't started playing yet.
It hurts you right now because there is a noticeable lack of depth when you're using O'Brien White up front. No offense to O'Brien White, but I'm not afraid of him. If I was a neutral in this game, I wouldn't be afraid of him.
Well, O'Brien White's coming on strong. Don't sleep on Obi.
Well. you have to look at the Union with stronger defense, probably right now the second best defense in the league behind Real Salt Lake, and that's easily defendable. 3 clean sheets a season, that's more than all of last year, and you got 2 in the first 2 games. It took up until the 20s last season, and the only problem right now is that the Union aren't scoring, whereas last year, even versus teams like Seattle, which had strong defense, strong midfield, they were scoring, even though they had a weaker overall team than this year.
Now, what is your explanation for that? You know, that's actually a good thing to bring up. The defense, it's not hard to figure out why the defense is better. You added Farid Mondragon, who is obviously a considerable improvement over the goalie situation you had a year ago. You added Carlos Valdez. You have Shannon Williams, who is, I don't believe, played in the game last year against the Sounders. He started playing around game 20 or so. But
he came in for the last 8
Welcome
games.
Welcome back to No Sadia Test.
Yeah, so, I mean, the defense, obviously, it's not hard to explain why the defense Scott is better. Kessler, but what's your – I mean, do you think that this is a blip on the screen as to why the offense is better? Is it a tactical difference? Why do you think it? I mean, what's your explanation for
sign off for today?
I guess 3 goals
we'll get
in
to mailbag
four games.
Next week. Well, hopefully, we'll have lots of questions and
one
Carl
Ruiz.
And go back and forth.
Now you think I would follow up by saying Carl Ruiz 2 more times, but
justice.
The second
that's
two
a phrase,
midfield
which I'm not sure
tactics
it is.
And midfield
but anyway,
selection.
This is Jeremiah O'Shan signing off for Aaron Campo. Thanks for listening.
I mean, with that, it's last year they were playing a 4-2-2-2 with 2 central midfielders and 2 attacking midfielders on the outside, and that really allowed Mwanga and Latu and Moreno and Latu to be free to do what they were doing best. This season, it's been a lot of Ruiz up front by himself, letting Latu go off on the right side and do what he does. And then you have Miguel Ranzi and Brian Carroll basically playing the exact same position, even though Brian Carroll is better. And you had Justin Mapp hurt for 2 of the past games. It's been a very convoluted mess of a situation.
And so is your expectation this is going to work? Obviously, I'm assuming that you don't believe that 0.75 goals per game is going to get you to the top of the Eastern Conference in the long run. I mean, what's your expectation in terms of how this kind of works itself out for the Union? Do they become a better offensive team, or do they kind of fall back a little bit?
Something has to give. And I think the thing that's going to give is Carlos Ruiz to the bench in favor of having Danny Mwanga start like he did last season. On top of that, Keon Daniel, who's a former Puerto Rico Islander, is a breath of fresh air in the midfield. Actually made some attacking runs, changed the style of attack out of the midfield. Omobi Okugo, who may be known to U.S. fans because of his U-20 play, showed a lot during the New York Rebels game, was able to make a lot of runs, even though he's somewhat of a defensive player, and clamped down a lot in the midfield during the second half. And I think what's really going to help is that Novak finally found a place for Roger Torres to really make an impact on the game as like a 65th minute sub. He's done a lot this season in a short period of time.
And so obviously I'll let you get going after this, but I would be remiss if I didn't at least ask you about Sebastian Letou. From the appearances, it looks like he's been kind of moved back into a midfield role, which is where he was playing with the Sounders and where he had a obvious where he was kind of had a frustrating season for the Sounders in year one. Now, is that fair to say that he's been moved back into a midfield role, or is he still essentially had the same freedoms that he had last year to kind of roam around and do whatever he has to do?
He has the same freedoms, but the way the team around him is structured, he doesn't have the same support. Last season, he was playing as, I'd say, halfway between a midfielder and a striker. There's obviously a term for it, but for Letou, I just call it the Letou. Because he literally has as much freedom as any player in soccer worldwide has to really do what he wants to do. And this season, he's had ineffective partners up front. He's had an ineffective midfield giving the ball. And defense have clamped around him because they've realized that he's really the threat. And then an ankle injury that he picked up really hobbled him for a good part of the beginning of this season. And it's all just come together and made it a mess for him so far. But I don't think you're going to really be able to count him out for this season. He's going to have a decline in his numbers from last year, no doubt. Nobody thought he was going to keep up the pace that he set last year. But I think it's reasonable to see him go double digits in either goals or assists and be close to it in the other one by the end of the season.
All right, I lied. I have one more question for you.
Shoot.
We do our weekly power rankings at SB Nation, and you were one of two people that had the Union in the top tier. Now, do you in your core believe that the Union are one of the two or three best teams in the league, or is that kind of you being a Union fan coming out?
The only time that any of you at SB Nation could legitimately call me out was how heavily I was pushing for Letou for MVP last season. But that's just my personal belief on the whole MVP process in America. I think that the Union, with the way they've been playing, where they showed that the only reason why the LA Galaxy beat them was because of a classic David Beckham free kick straight to the head of someone running in towards goal. I mean, otherwise, they were getting beaten in possession, but the Galaxy really weren't threatening goal. Otherwise, this entire season's been pure defensive domination. And if you can play great defense and keep it up and have Farid Mondragon not give up goals, you're going to win games 1-0. We saw Manchester United do that in 2009 on their way to a Champions League final. They had 1-0 games up and down the board. They're getting criticized for it, but you know what? If that's how you win, that's how you win. And in the end, Novak's eventually going to find a way to make this offense and midfield creative, and that's going to allow the defense to be able to not be the only, you know, not be the focal point of this entire team.
All right, well, I really appreciate your time, Scott. That, again, you should really check out Scott's blog, brotherlygame.com. It's one of the great SB Nation blogs. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Well, thanks for having me on, and we'll be talking to you throughout the week over at Brotherly Game.
Welcome back to Nos Arietes. Hopefully you enjoyed that little segment we did with Scott Kessler of Brotherly Game. We were planning on ending the show today with a mailbag. Some technical difficulties made that less than ideal. So basically, I'm going to sign off for today. We'll get to mailbag next week. Hopefully we'll have lots of questions, and Aaron and I can kind of go back and forth and give them their due justice, if that's a phrase, which I'm not sure it is. But anyway, this was Jeremiah O'Shan signing off for Aaron Campo. Thanks for listening. See you on Sound Radar.